is not the end of everything, but the beginning of something. It is a new beginning because we will live something we have never fully lived before, eternity. The thoughts of Pope Francis on old age and death, his previously unpublished written reflections, released this week by the Vatican, one day following his passing. It is with a heavy heart that we welcome you this week to EWTN News In Depth. I'm Catherine Hadro, bringing to you our coverage of the death of our Holy Father, Pope Francis. After an Easter Sunday in which he made an appearance to bless the faithful in St. Peter's Square and a ride in the Popemobile to greet the crowd, we awoke Easter Monday to learn the Pope had died. The Bishop of Rome and former Archbishop of Buenos Aires, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, dead at the age of 88 after a sudden stroke and heart failure. Bells tolled slowly as Pope Francis's coffin was transferred to St. Peter's Basilica for his body to lie in state for 3 days before his solemn funeral on Saturday. The coffin was laid at the altar of the Confessio, a sacred space in front of the main tomb of St. Peter. After the funeral, there will be an official mourning period of 9 days called the Novendiales. Each day, a different cardinal will celebrate a public funeral rite for the Holy Father. At the end of the Novendiales, the College of Cardinals will prepare for and then enter the conclave in the Sistine Chapel, during which time 135 cardinal electors will cast their ballots until a consensus of 2/3 of them selects a new pope. But for now, the focus remains on Pope Francis, known as the People's Pope by some for his embrace of all humanity, particularly people he saw on the margins. During the 3 days of lying in state, more than 100,000 pilgrims entered St. Peter's to pray for the Pope and to honor his work on earth. The faithful waited in long lines for hours during both day and evening. The Vatican even kept the doors of St. Peter's open longer than initially announced to try to accommodate the large crowds of people who wanted to pay their respects. What legacy does this Pope of the people leave the world? He was a unique papacy, never seen before. The first Latin American, the first Jesuit, a Pope with a humble persona. EWTN's former Vatican Bureau Chief Alan Holdren brings us perspective.
Popes are often remembered for some standout element in their lives or pontificates. Benedict XVI was the professor and theologian. John Paul II has been remembered as the Pope of the family. John the 23rd as the smiling Pope or the good Pope. So how will Pope Francis be remembered?
Pope Francis's priority was stated, I think, at one of the general congregations before he was elected, which is a church that is not stuck in on itself, but knows how to go out and reach out, what he calls the peripheries.
The Pope of the peripheries. But he wasn't just focused on reaching out to people in the city slums or at the geographical ends of the earth.
He was speaking also about people who are on the margins, who are marginalized in other ways. The disabled, the mentally ill, the homeless, abuse victims. All of these groups of people, he went out of his way to meet with prisoners during his pontificate. And so when he preached about Christians, about Catholics having care for the poor, about going out to the peripheries, he did the same. He didn't just speak about it, he did it.
He's not from the left, he's not from the right. He wanted to cancel the globalization of indifference. I mean that you cannot stay calm while people are suffering near to you. I think this is very Christian.
And as the whole world suffered at the outset of the COVID pandemic, it was Pope Francis who encouraged us all through it. Who could forget the extraordinary moment of prayer in St. Peter's Square when he addressed the desolation and uncertainty of billions and offered all of humanity up to God's protection?
From this colonnade that embraces Rome and the whole world, May God's blessing come down upon you as a consoling embrace. Lord, may you bless the world, give health to our bodies, and comfort our hearts.
E conforto ai cuori.
From his pulpit here in Rome, but also during his travels around the world, he instructed, he counseled, and he prayed, never missing an opportunity to proclaim God's unbounded mercy.
Judging that attention to those most in need, people have long referred to him as the Pope of Mercy. Pope Francis based many of his actions and activities in the corporal and spiritual works of mercy. He constantly comforted the sorrowful, reached out to the poorest of the poor, visited the sick and those in jail. Pope Francis made the unexpected decision even to call an extraordinary Jubilee Year of Mercy for 2016. And on the occasion, he also sent out missionaries of mercy, priests given a special mandate to go out in his name to preach mercy and especially to hear confessions and bring God's forgiveness to the people. Father Roger Landry was one of them. Being a missionary of mercy has given him the chance to gauge the legacy of Pope Francis among the people.
I think Pope Francis' inheritance will be threefold. First, it's going to be his priority for mercy, which he showed in terms of his own personal life, as well as in sending out the missionaries of mercy and calling a Jubilee for mercy. The second is not forgetting anybody. He really cared about those on what he called the existential peripheries, and he focused on them perhaps even more than those on the center. And then third, I think he will be known for what he said to the youth of the world in Brazil in 2013. He encouraged them to go out and hacer lío, Spanish for make a mess. And he has caused a little confusion himself by some of his decisions, as well as by some of the things that he hasn't paid attention to. And so whoever his successor is will have to bring a little bit of order to the lío or to the chaos that Pope Francis himself promoted.
The Pope of Mess. Some say he was just a shepherd, leaving the 99 to go after the one lost sheep.
Once I asked the Pope if he was worried in that the fact that he was speaking mainly to the ones who are far away and that the ones who are closer feel a little bit alone. And he said, well, if the people are really closer, they are happy that I'm speaking with the ones that are far away.
Just as his namesake, Saint Francis, Pope Francis took on rebuilding the church. Some referred to him as a reformer, as he created a new apostolic constitution to restructure how the Roman Curia serves the Pope and the Church, and invited church leadership to be synodal, a group effort guided by listening. And his changes weren't just structural, they were meant to reform hearts.
I ask once if he has the perception that he was changing the culture, the Catholic culture. And he said that all the lay people, especially the lay peoples who are Catholic, change the culture because they give hope and they give perspective. And I think that this is what he was trying to say with his pontificate, to give hope and also to give a long perspective, not only a perspective of today.
To give hope. He dedicated the 2025 Jubilee Year to Hope, titling the official papal bull of indiction, Spes non confundit, Hope Does Not Disappoint. In it, he wrote, Christian hope does not deceive or disappoint because it is grounded in the certainty that nothing and no one may ever separate us from God's love. A key message in Pope Francis's reign, so much so that he titled his 2025 autobiography simply, Hope. Hannah Brockhaus covered most of his pontificate as Catholic news agency's senior Rome correspondent, studying him day in and day out for the better part of a decade.
If you look at the latter years, I think you could also call him the Pope of Peace. He focused a lot on messages of peace. He made many appeals for Ukraine during the conflict with Russia. And he was also the first pope to visit Iraq And he was also able to set foot in the Democratic Republic of Congo. That was really important to him. There, in both places, he gave really important messages of peace, and even just by being in those places, a strong message of peace. His emphasis on a synodal church, and I think his emphasis as well on ecumenism, on Christian dialogue, interreligious dialogue, I think he made some huge strides in those areas and in unifying the church and bringing us one step closer, hopefully, to being unified in those areas. In other areas, people may feel more divided over some of the decisions Pope Francis made.
The Pope of Unity. He hired Argentinian Marcelo Figueroa as the first Protestant columnist in the more than 160-year history of the Vatican's newspaper.
He's a pope that opened himself in a productive, exciting, determined way, with parisia, as he says, to the true encounter with Christians of other faiths, with the Muslim, with the Jew, with indigenous peoples, with all religions. And really, he had such a great impact that he will perhaps be remembered as the most important ecumenical, interreligious, and intercultural figure in the history of humanity.
Whether he's remembered as the Pope of the Peripheries, the Pope of Mercy, the Pope of Mess, the Reformer Pope, the Pope of Hope, the Pope of Peace, or the Pope of Dialogue, he will always be the first Pope Francis, the Pope who always asked that the world not forget to pray for him.
As we just heard, Francis was known to continuously reach out with compassion to the flock under his care. In the days after his passing, the global church reacted in kind, uniting in mourning and prayer for its shepherd.
From the most iconic cathedrals in the world,
we feel empty, but at the same time, he is resting.
To the small churches on the peripheries beloved by the late pontiff.
I feel so lost and so sad. I think that the world has lost a father, but heaven received a saint.
Catholics around the world held masses and prayer services for Pope Francis. In Taiwan, worshippers lit incense and wrote messages of condolences.
He was always like a father to us, and like a family member who goes away, I feel that I want to keep hold of him, but I can't.
The loss of Pope Francis is deeply felt in the Democratic Republic of Congo, a violence-stricken African nation that he held close to his heart. Catholics there recalled the Pope's visit in 2023 and his constant calls for peace.
I remember that when he spoke, he never forgot to think of praying for peace. Many times he prayed for the Democratic Republic of Congo, our very dear country.
The Holy Father's death is personal in his native Argentina, where he served as priest and archbishop long before succeeding Saint Peter. Many remember him for his outreach to the poorest of the poor.
To the most humble people in Argentina, Francis gave them the conviction to perceive themselves with the dignity God gave them. They matter.
Bishops and cardinals joined their people in prayer for the repose of the Holy Father's soul. Global leaders, too, have expressed their condolences to the Catholic community for our loss, remembering the Pope as an inspiring advocate for compassion and peace. President Donald Trump also commemorated the Pope's life, ordering federal buildings across the country to fly the flag at half staff until tomorrow, when Francis is interred. Both he and former President Joe Biden are expected to attend the funeral at the Vatican. Vice President J.D. Vance, a Catholic convert who publicly clashed with the Holy Father on the issue of immigration just months ago, was one of the last officials to meet with Pope Francis on Easter Sunday. When speaking with reporters later in the week, he said meeting with the late pontiff during his final day was a great blessing. EWTN News in Depth spoke to many people who said Pope Francis was a blessing in their lives, from Catholic to those of other faiths to people who were not religious. This pope and the example he set made a difference. Here is reporter Mark Irons.
What will you remember most about Pope Francis?
His infectious smile. Oh my gosh, when he smiles, he lights up every corner.
Reflections on the life of Pope Francis, coming from all corners.
He was just an amazing human being.
I'm not even religious, but I do like his values.
I just thought he was a wonderful man, humble. So glad we had him and brought new life to the church.
As masses in memory of the late Pope were held across the U.S. this week, we heard from many Catholics. What's on your mind today as we reflect on the life of Pope Francis?
Just the beautiful life he led.
Pope Francis, we love you.
Bishop Michael Burbage, the head of the Arlington Diocese in Virginia, among those feeling the loss of someone close.
What I'm experiencing right now is the loss of a father, the loss of a family member.
When you think about Pope Francis, what comes to mind?
Solidarity with the poor. He changed my way of thinking.
I love how joyful he was and how welcoming and loving he was to everybody, to the poor, to the marginalized.
He's humble, just like Jesus.
That's what I remember the most about this Pope.
Humble guy.
Absolutely. Man of the people.
A Pope who reached out to the people of all generations. What impact do you think Pope Francis has had on young Catholics' lives?
I think in a lot of ways he allowed for us to come back into the church with more fervor.
I converted into the faith last year, and he was just, I mean, really just a representative of a really great person to, you know, follow and kind of follow in the footsteps of.
This 14-year-old girl from Texas shared how Pope Francis once responded to a letter she wrote him.
To just write to me, just a normal kid, just to respond and just... I don't know, it just, it felt like he had come down to my level and just, like, spoke to me personally.
But it wasn't just Catholics who felt the Francis effect.
I think he was accessible. I think he, you know, I'm not Catholic, my wife is Catholic, I'm Jewish, but I felt like he made us, most of us, feel welcomed.
So he was a man who did a lot of good work, and you have to give him honor for that.
What kind of message do you think Pope Francis had for the world?
Whatever I've seen, whatever I've read online, it definitely seems the message that he left was one of peace.
This Muslim man saw Francis as a champion of world peace.
And another one that I would say is of hope. It's that message of hope, and it resonates with, like I'm standing here saying I'm a testament that his messages resonate with even me.
Back in 2015, Pope Francis brought a message to America, cutting across divided political lines when he addressed Congress.
Let us treat others with the same passion and compassion with which we want to be treated.
His historic visit to Washington, D.C. included the first canonization on U.S. soil at the largest Catholic church in North America. He also made high-profile stops at places of earthly power, the White House, and the U.S. Capitol building.
Thank you very much, and God bless America.
One of the Pope's lesser-known stops was right here on this simple city sidewalk, where fittingly, he spent time with homeless men and women. Pope Francis joined them for a meal. This final stop was focused on feeding the hungry.
In the name of the Father, of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Y buen apetito.
At that time, our EWTN news coverage of the event included some of the same sounding reflections we're hearing since the Pope passed.
He walked right past him. He has a love for the people. He just has a great love for the people.
Acknowledging the love he had for his people. That even heard this week among those Catholics who questioned some of the things Pope Francis might have said or done.
You can see his dedication to his flock. But at the end of the day, no pope is going to be perfect. No pope has ever been perfect.
Pater, his filius.
This pope has passed, but the life of the church continues on as it has for over 2,000 years.
I think what I'll take away is to be Catholic and spread the Catholic faith.
I hope people from around the world see this about our Holy Catholic Church. It's the Lord's Church. Founded on the apostles.
And Bishop Burbidge says we can honor Pope Francis by living what he left us.
Honor him by embracing in our lives those things that he taught us in his writings, and most especially the example, namely to respect everyone as a child of God, radiate the joy that comes in having a relationship with the Lord, living his gospel, go out to those who need us the most.
Mark Irons, EWTN News in Denver.
We go now to St. Peter's Square, where we are joined by longtime Vatican analyst Delia Gallagher. Delia, thank you so much for joining us. You have covered the Vatican for years. Can you give us a sense of what you're seeing around you right now, the mood of the people and the impact on them of the Pope's passing?
You know, Catherine, as much as this is a solemn event, of course, there is a sense here in the crowd of a kind of anticipation, a kind of electricity, because I think not only are they able to go into the Basilica and see the Pope, but this was something that happened also for them out of the blue. Many people here were just here for vacation. And so they too are experiencing, as we all are, this strange mix of both sorrow at the death of a pope, but at the same time, the realization that this is a historical event that they now also get to participate in. Today is also an Italian national holiday, so we're seeing an influx of many more Italians as well. Catherine?
Delia, after Pope Francis's death, the Vatican released his final testament, which outlined his last wishes. What are the key points in that testament?
So Francis wrote a last will and testament, and in that he said the things that we already know, which is he wants to be buried in St. Mary Major's. He wants to only have a simple wooden coffin. Now, interestingly, the Master of Papal Ceremonies told us today that one of the things that will be reflected in the liturgy, the Pope chose the readings and chose some of the liturgical events that will be happening, and he wanted that to reflect him being a pastor and not a sovereign, he said. Catherine?
Delia, you observed Pope Francis closely throughout his pontificate. How were his final days emblematic of his papacy overall?
Well, I mean, you know, what better way to spend your final day on earth than on Easter Sunday in St. Peter's Square? I mean, it was kind of incredible, actually, that he was able to go through the crowds once more, to give the blessing of the Urbi et Orbi, a final blessing. Incredible for the Pope, but also incredible for all of the people who were in the square. The other very symbolic thing, I think, that happened on that Sunday was his meeting with Vice President J.D. Vance. The Vatican press corps certainly did not know that that was going to happen. I'm not sure about the White House press corps, because the vice president had an official meeting on Saturday with the Cardinal Secretary of State. And we thought, well, maybe he's going to meet with the Pope on Saturday. That didn't happen. And then suddenly on Sunday, there's this meeting that happened actually while the mass was going on out here. And I thought that was a rather symbolic end, knowing now that that was his last official meeting, because, of course, a lot of the Pope's message about poverty and economics was geared towards wealthy, powerful countries like the United States. So I thought this meeting between a Catholic vice president of the United States and Pope Francis for his last official meeting had a lot of symbolism in it. Catherine?
Delia, can you walk us through what we should expect following Pope Francis's funeral mass?
So what's going to be really interesting after the funeral, Catherine, and what's going to be new, so we're all going to see it for the first time, is, of course, Francis wants to be buried at St. Mary Major's, which is a basilica about maybe 15-minute drive from here, but they're going to take the car very slowly because there will likely be people along the streets that will want to see that. So once the funeral is finished, they will take the coffin back inside. There will be a bit of time that we won't see, and then we will see the car leave from the Vatican and take this route through the streets of Rome. It should be quite beautiful. To St. Mary Major's, and then at the door of St. Mary Major's, we have been told that there will be a group of poor and underprivileged people who have been close to the Pope there to give him his final greeting before he is entombed.
What should we expect to see during the Novendiales, or the 9 days of mourning?
So the 9 days of mourning, this tradition, this historical tradition here at the Vatican, begins with the funeral mass. And then the following day, we'll see here in the piazza, the Cardinal Secretary of State begin the second day, essentially, of the Novendiales, 9 days of masses. And those are masses in the Basilica and here outside that are a chance, really, for a lot of the people that worked with the Pope and, of course, for all of the pilgrims to pray for him and to experience those 9 days of official mourning. Catherine?
And finally, Delia, from your time as a Vatican journalist and analyst, did you ever have an interaction with Pope Francis that stands out to you?
I've had many interactions with Francis, mostly on papal trips, because, of course, when we're on the airplane with him, he comes back and says hello. And, you know, the thing about Francis was that he just loved kind of the common touch. And so I used to just give him little tidbits about my kids. And I came back from maternity leave. I had a boy, and I was back on the plane, and he said, "Oh, you're back." And I said, "Yes, you know, well, I had a son. I've called him Francesco," which, of course, is the Italian for Francis, you know. And he says, "Oh, bene, bene." And then I suddenly thought, oh, he thinks I'm trying to, you know, flatter him. So I said, "I didn't name him after you. I named him for my father-in-law." And he said, "Oh," he thought that was very funny. And then he said, "That was good idea, good for the inheritance." So he loved those kind of little, you know, of the people sort of anecdotes. So I used to do that a lot with him. Catherine?
Delia Gallagher, thank you so much for joining us. When we come back, more reflections on the life of Pope Francis. We talked to a priest who spent years at the Vatican at Pope Francis's side, providing English translation for the Pope in both his written word and conversations with people ranging from world leaders to everyday Catholics.
Just a beautiful person. And we're so lucky we had him.
His heart was pastoral, and that was constantly what he was asking. How is the faith helping people, particularly in their moments of greatest need?
For me, it's the greatest gift Pope Francis has given us. He's gone, but his legacy remains in our hearts.
We just decided to come last minute, so we came, flew from Dublin last night. We're staying for one day, home tonight then. So just felt it was very important to be here.
He was a good Pope. I just hope that we have someone that's just as good, that takes his place.
Before Pope Francis's body was transferred to St. Peter's Basilica to lie in state, he first lay in an open coffin in the chapel of his Santa Marta residence, where he chose to live throughout his papacy. On Monday evening, Cardinal Camerlengo Kevin Farrell presided over the rite of the ascertainment of death and the placement of the late pontiff's body in the coffin. The same day, the seals were placed on the doors of Pope Francis's apartment. Most Catholics only knew our Holy Father from afar, but our next guest provides us with a rare up-close insight into the late pontiff's personality and pastoral legacy. Monsignor Paul de Laderante, now Chancellor of the Diocese of Arlington, Virginia, previously served in the English section of the Vatican Secretariat of State. He was one of the English interpreters for Pope Francis from 2018 to 2024, handling correspondence and facilitating conversations with heads of state, celebrities, dignitaries of all kinds, and English-speaking bishop. He joins us now in studio to discuss the legacy of Pope Francis. Monsignor, thank you for being here. My condolences as we in the church are mourning the loss of our Holy Father.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you very much.
Absolutely. And you really did have such a window into Pope Francis's life for more than 5 years. First, can you describe Pope Francis's personality? What was he like at these various meetings that you attended?
I would say two things stood out especially. First, he was a man of prayer. Before every meeting, whether it was with an individual, a small group, or a larger group, he would spend a moment in prayer. It wasn't lengthy, it was brief, but he was very much focused. And I have no doubt he was asking the Holy Spirit for wisdom, for guidance, and the courage to say what he wanted to say and to listen with patience and understanding to what the visitors would want to tell him. The second quality that kind of stood out to me was his just human warmth and kindness. He listened patiently. He treated everyone like a brother or sister in Christ. Mm. And to him, they were not just anonymous individuals. Mm. They were neighbors in the human family, mm-hmm. and, of course, certainly in the family of God.
Is there a particularly memorable moment or anecdote that stands out to you from your time working so closely with Pope Francis?
Well, I remember two in particular. Mm. One was Sylvester Stallone. He came with his wife and children, his brother, and some other people to say hello to Pope Francis. Mm-hmm. And I had been asked to interpret for the bishops of Zimbabwe, who were coming on their ad limina visit, which bishops make mm-hmm, periodically mm-hmm. to the Holy Father. And one of the priests in the papal household said to me, would you mind interpreting for Sylvester Stallone before the bishops go into the apostolic library? So, of course, I said, Sylvester Stallone, of course. And it was just very, very funny because the Pope greeted him and then said to him, I watched your movies when I was young. And Sylvester Stallone said, that's great, you know, do you want a box? And Pope Francis put out his arm like this with almost a perfect left jab. And I thought to myself, I don't think Stallone knows that the Pope, as a young man before he went in the seminary, worked as a bouncer in a nightclub for a period. And so he could handle this.
He had good form,
He had good form, excellent form. And it was very, very funny just to watch that. And then the other incident that kind of stands out was Pope Francis had heard that there were a group of players from the NBA, National Basketball Association, who were fighting against racism, especially in this country. And so he got in touch with the Players Association.
Right.
And some of them, plus some of the players themselves, came to the Holy See for a visit. And this was at the Pope's initiative. Well, when they walked in to the Apostolic Library, the first one was one of the players, and he kind of ducked down to get through the door. And the Pope was waiting to greet him, and he stood up. And Pope Francis's whole eyes and face just lit up, and he smiled, and he looked up like this. Very animated. He couldn't believe he was so tall. So it was a great moment.
Thank you for sharing that, because it does give us even more insight into his personality and overall demeanor. You know, you're someone who was and is especially steeped into Pope Francis's words and his writings. When you look back, were there certain themes that came up over and over again in his various correspondence?
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm. I think first there was his care for the poor.
Mm-hmm.
From the beginning of his pontificate, he always wanted not only the church, but the world, leaders, governments, ordinary people, never to neglect or forget about those who were on the margins, on the peripheries, as he always called them.
Mm-hmm.
And that he said, this is part of who we are and should be as a church, because Jesus went to the poor. Jesus went to those who were on the margins of the society of his time, and we're called to do the same. And that was a theme that I think comes through all of his writings, his addresses, his talks. He never wanted us to forget that.
Mm.
Secondly, I think he wanted the church to be missionary. This came through from the very first apostolic exhortation that he wrote, Evangelii Gaudium, the joy of the gospel, when he said, I dream of a missionary church, a church that goes out to bear witness to Christ, to bear witness to the gift of his love, the gift of friendship with God. And that's what Jesus brings us, and that's what we as followers of Jesus are called to bring to others. So he always spoke of mission.
Absolutely.
And then the third characteristic, I think, that shines through his writings and his talks was his strong defense of the dignity of every person. Mm. From conception all the way through death, at every stage of a person's life, Pope Francis constantly reminded the world that every life is valuable, every human life has dignity.
You came back to the U.S. about a year ago in 2024, And I'm curious, as the world watched, as you watched Pope Francis's long stay in the hospital in February and his final days during Holy Week and then ultimately his passing on Easter Monday, what was going through your mind?
Well, I think as many people may have thought when he went into the hospital and had some serious moments there with the pneumonia and trying to fight off the infection and what he was dealing with, you do wonder, would he come out? Would he really recover? Mm-hmm. And when he did, he started to recover. He regained some of his strength. And I'm pretty sure he probably fought with his doctors and said, no, I want to go back to the Vatican. I want to go home. Mm-hmm. Which he did. And his doctors, as we know, had told him, just rest for a couple of months, avoid audiences. But he just was a person of very, very strong will. And I think he wanted to do what he was going to do. Mm. That is to be a pastor, to be, the shepherd, to be the Bishop of Rome, to be the leader of the church, and he was going to meet with whomever he wanted to meet with. Mm. So in one sense, it was not surprising to me that on Easter Sunday, he would have come out on the balcony of St. Peter's to impart his blessing, urbi et orbi, to the city and to the world, and then to drive around through the crowds of pilgrims that were there, because that was what he wanted to do. Yeah. He wanted, I think, to give what turned out to be his final blessing, and he wanted to be among the people, as he, again, had urged the church to go out and be among the people, to be among the sheep of the flock. And he lived that right to the end.
Monsignor, thank you so much for your time and helping us all get to know Pope Francis a little bit better.
You're welcome.
Thank you. The scheduled Sunday canonization of Blessed Carlo Acutis is postponed following the death of Pope Francis and the chair of St. Peter being vacant. More than 80,000 teenagers were expected to gather in Rome this weekend for the canonization, taking place amid the Jubilee of Teenagers. The news of Pope Francis's passing broke as pilgrims were already beginning to arrive for it. The Jubilee is continuing on this weekend with a few scheduled changes. Blessed Carlo Acutis is the first millennial beatified in the church. He died of leukemia in 2006 at the age of 15 and is known for his devotion to the Eucharist. No word yet as to when his canonization will be rescheduled. Tomorrow, EWTN will bring you the solemn funeral mass for His Holiness Pope Francis from the Vatican. The funeral is at 4 a.m. Eastern time. Our coverage begins at 3 a.m. Eastern. The repeat will air at 6 p.m. Eastern, and join EWTN in praying for the repose of the Holy Father's soul through daily Mass and the Rosary. Find our schedule and learn more about our interregnum coverage at EWTN.com. News headlines are next in the Week in Review.
Today we ask the justices to uphold our freedom to raise our children according to our faith and values, free from government interference.
Parents fight for the right to opt out their children from LGBTQ material taught in a public school system. We're at the U.S. Supreme Court.
This was a moment in time that we'll always remember, but it's also a moment in time that has changed us forever and can be a source of good for us.
And 30 years after the Oklahoma City bombing, the reaffirmation of faith at the Catholic Cathedral across the street from the worst act of domestic terrorism in American history. EWTN News in Depth is coming right back. Massive airstrikes on Ukraine's capital, top headlines in the Week in Review. Russia's attack was its deadliest on Kyiv in nearly a year, even prompting a rare rebuke from President Trump. Emergency workers combed debris from devastated civilian buildings early Thursday morning. The missile and drone attack killed at least 12 people and left nearly 100 injured. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky shortened his diplomatic trip to South Africa shortly after the strikes. Trump, who has used his second term to try to thaw relations between the U.S. and Russia, told Russian President Vladimir Putin to stop, calling the strikes not necessary and very bad timing in a Truth Social post. Those strikes come as peace talks between Ukraine and Russia seem to hit a dead end after the U.S. did not attend negotiations in London. Ukrainian and European officials met on Wednesday, but without the U.S. at the table, no breakthroughs were made. Trump has voiced frustration at the stalled talks, even threatening to walk away from negotiations entirely if no progress is made soon. Trump doubled down on Zelensky's side of the deal, pressuring him to recognize Russia's illegal annexation of the Crimea Peninsula. But Zelensky says that's a concession Ukraine will never agree to. A major case about religious and parental rights at the Supreme Court. A group of parents is asking the justices to allow them to opt out their children from school curriculum they say violates their religious beliefs. Roselle Regis reports.
Pride Puppy, Prince and Knight, Uncle Bobby's Wedding, and Born Ready, the true story of a boy named Penelope. Maryland's Montgomery County Schools incorporated these LGBTQ-inclusive storybooks into their curriculum in 2022 for students pre-K to 8th grade, introducing the concept of pride parades, same-sex marriages, gender transitioning, and pronoun preferences. Some parents did not agree to this. Initially, those who objected were allowed to opt their children out of the lessons. But the district went back on its policy in 2023, stating opt-outs would not be allowed beginning in 2023 to 2024 school year.
What do we want?
Opt-out!
When do we want it?
No!
Some parents protested at board meetings for months, to no avail. That's when they sued the school system.
Who has the core responsibility for the education and also the values being instituted into your children? Is it the parents? Is it the state?
This is what Supreme Court justices have to consider after lower courts sided with the school district. The case in hand, Mahmoud versus Taylor. The parents, who are Christians, Muslims, and Jewish, argued that the LGBTQ plus books interfere with their religious liberty rights by exposing their children to gender and sexuality norms that conflict with their religion. This week, the Supreme Court's conservative majority signaled support for the religious rights of the parents, but not without some pushback.
I guess I'm struggling to see how it burdens a parent's religious exercise if the school teaches something that the parent disagrees with. You have a choice. You don't have to send your kid to that school. You can put them in another situation.
Okay, so it's not about exposure. It's not about books on the shelf. It's not about books in the library. It's about actually reading the books with the text that communicates the ideas that are contrary to your client's sincerely held religious beliefs.
I'm standing in front of the Supreme Court where oral arguments are taking place inside, but outside there are rallies.
The more exposure and knowledge and understanding kids have, I think the less apt they will be to bullying.
This is for all parents. It's for our friends over there as well. I'm fighting for them as well and their parental rights, because there could be something that a teacher wants to teach in a public school that goes against their religious beliefs.
After the oral argument, we spoke to attorney Eric Baxter of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty. He represents the parents in the case.
We were optimistic about our chances. They seemed very concerned about the content of the school books, the instruction to teachers to disrupt students either or thinking about sex, to rewrite the norms, and to just really do things that are contrary to the things that their parents are trying to teach them.
Meanwhile, the attorney for the school district, Alan Schoenfeld, maintained that no students are being coerced and that opt-outs would be unsustainable.
And a constitutional requirement to provide opt-outs from anything someone finds religiously offensive would mean public schools must find alternative classrooms, supervision for young students, and substitute lessons each time a potentially offensive topic arises.
Montgomery County Public Schools also issued the following statement. As our counsel told the court, MCPCS's policy is grounded in our commitment to provide an appropriate classroom environment for all our students. We believe a curriculum that fosters respect for people of different backgrounds does not burden the free exercise of religion. The case has wide implications, with parental rights advocates from other states chiming in, like California's Protect Our Kids group.
So my hope, Roselle, is that these kinds of cases will act as a catalyst for parents across the country to realize what's going on in the public school system and to take direct action by getting more involved, by learning what's going on or running for school board, so that both from the top down and the bottoms up, we start to see positive change, particularly for our children in this country.
Organizations which have authored amicus briefs in support of the district include the American Civil Liberties Union, the National Education Association, and PEN America, an organization that champions the freedom to write and express ideas. They fear a decision in favor of the parents will turbocharge book bans and add that opt-out policies for LGBTQ plus books stigmatizes children and families who identify as part of that community. A decision in Mahmoud v. Taylor is expected by late June or early July. Rossell Regis, EWTN, News in Depth.
Next Wednesday, the Supreme Court will hear another major case on religious freedom. Justices will determine whether a Catholic charter school in Oklahoma, the first of its kind in the nation, violates the separation of church and state. The case could reshape school choice across the country and pave the way for state-funded religious education. Just last month, the court examined the work of Catholic Charities and whether its service to the poor is religious enough for tax exemption. Earlier in the term, the justices discussed age verification for pornography sites and transgender procedures for minors. Decisions in all these cases are expected to be released by late June or early July. Last Saturday marked the 30th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing, the deadliest domestic terrorist attack in U.S. history. A public ceremony at the memorial site included a reading of all the names of all 168 people who were killed. Two former U.S. Army soldiers were convicted in the bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building, which included the offices of the FBI, Secret Service, the Social Security Administration, and a daycare center. Timothy McVie drove a rental truck packed with explosives to the site and lit the fuse, which set off a blast so powerful it sheared off a third of the building and caused floors to collapse on each other. Among the 168 dead were babies from the daycare center. A memorial now at the site has 168 chairs in memory of each of the victims. Authorities initially suspected international extremists, but the perpetrators turned out to be domestic terrorists with deep-seated anger towards the federal government. Among those attending last weekend's remembrance was a survivor who was working on the first floor of the building when the bomb exploded.
There's a lot of PTSD that is there, and it never goes away. So we need each other. We need help. If we communicate, we're able to cope with it a lot better.
The Oklahoma City bombing was not only a turning point in American history, it was also a turning point for a Catholic church just yards from ground zero. The impact is still being felt three decades later, as Alan Holdren reports.
Here in the heart of Oklahoma City, they're marking the April the 19th anniversary of 30 years since the Oklahoma City bombing. It's a solemn occasion, remembering family, friends, and forebears whose lives were ended abruptly.
Please join me in 168 seconds of silence.
The Remembrance Day event at Oklahoma City's Methodist First Church includes a moment of silence for each of the 168 victims of the deadliest act of domestic terrorism in United States history. The nine-story tall Alfred Murrah Federal Building was largely destroyed by the blast. In the tangled rubble, so many died, and many more were wounded.
I was at home and saw it on the news and thought, oh, it had to be a natural gas explosion because it's Oklahoma. You would never think something like that would happen here, and unfortunately it did. It was such a sad day, and I'm sure we all were weeping with Jesus.
Denise Waters is the sacristan at St. Joseph's Old Cathedral, just across the street from the site of the bombing, which has been made into the Oklahoma City National Memorial and Museum. St. Joe's Old Cathedral is so close, in fact, that it was another casualty of the bombing. The blast lifted its very roof.
At some places, the plaster from the ceiling was a foot deep, and all the stained glass was pretty much blown out. The whole bombing, I mean, it damaged the organ. Evidently, pipes fell down to this floor from upstairs. But the sanctuary lamp never went out. So Jesus was always with us, even through something that horrific.
I came into the world to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs.
Father Aaron Foshi was just a second grader back then, but now he's in charge of the old cathedral.
It was not safe to be in the church at the time, so we had to rebuild a lot of it in that respect. But I believe it took about between 1 and 2 years.
Not everything was saved.
That's the original, that's where the Weeping Jesus statue is. That was where our rectory was.
Today, a statue titled Jesus Wept stands in the original rectory's place as a memorial to those who died. 168 niches in the wall, within view of the massive federal building memorial, where his many monuments fill the field of empty chairs in remembrance of the dead. Visitors with and without faith are drawn to the powerful message the Jesus sculpture offers.
Even in the midst of hatred, in the midst of sorrow and pain, that the Lord is with us. He commiserates with us. He shares in our suffering and is with us and doesn't leave us, even though he is weeping in the midst of great tragedy, but also in solidarity with those who were lost and changed forever.
Hundreds of thousands of people have come here over the decades to pay their respects, says Father Foshi. He calls St. Joseph's Old Cathedral a beacon for all Oklahomans, a pilgrimage site for Catholics and non-Catholics alike, and a sign that rebuilding and reconciling is possible.
The reality is that, especially when we see our Blessed Lord and the Weeping Jesus statue, we can also connect his desire to show mercy, even to those who have caused suffering. And so this is a great opportunity to evangelize. Even here, our Lord shows that kind of mercy, so we're called to as well. And I'm really proud of my fellow Oklahomans. I think we've done that really well.
When we first would come down to Oklahoma City and go over to the bombing, you could just feel the sorrowful souls. And now it's been renewed. There's a sense of joy that has sprung forth. And God makes everything new again and brings good out of really bad.
And on the 30th anniversary, as the people of Oklahoma City continue to offer up their grief to God, incredibly, they're also thanking him for his goodness. Alan Holdren, EWTN News In Depth.
Before the bombing in 1995, St. Joseph's Old Cathedral had dwindling attendance and was down to just one mass per week. As a testament to the rebirth of the city, Catholics have flocked back to the church, which now offers daily mass and regular confession times. We go back to the Vatican and more images from St. Peter's Basilica, where the faithful are gathered to mourn Pope Francis when we return. The world will celebrate the life of Pope Francis and pray for the repose of his soul tomorrow morning at his funeral in St. Peter's Basilica. EWTN will begin our live coverage from the Vatican at 3 a.m. Eastern. The solemn funeral mass for His Holiness Pope Francis will begin at 4 a.m. EWTN will air a repeat broadcast of the funeral that evening at 6 p.m. Eastern. There's much more to our interregnum coverage. Find reflections on the Holy Father's life and pray for the repose of his soul through daily mass and the rosary. Find our schedule and other resources at EWTN.com. Millions around the world have watched this week as the official interregnum events unfolded at the Vatican. As we close our program today, the EWTN Vatican Bureau provides these images of the mourning of the People's Pope, Jorge Mario Bergoglio, Pope Francis, the Bishop of Rome.
In nomine Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sancti. Spes Christi, qui mortuus surrexit, sit cum omnibus vobis.